Brian, who's your favorite mass murderer who started out in Nauvoo?
Can I only pick one?
Okay, well, why don't we start with John D. Lee, the man who took the fall for and certainly did his fair share of the murdering in the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Don't y'all ever want to know about some of these wild characters before they became important to Mormon history? Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
So Lindsay and I have talked about this. We decided we want to do a couple episodes from time to time where we'll talk about these prominent folks in later Mormon history, but we'll talk about their early church experiences, which are probably less well known. So, you know, we know these guys from the frontier period. That's why they're famous. But they don't really show up as much in our collective consciousness when you think of earlier periods. So guys like Jedediah Grant, the man later known as Brigham Sledgehammer, that's a nickname to remember. So, you know, during the Mormon Reformation period, he's very famous. But what about him earlier? So you know him as the dude with the heartwarming conference quotes like, "We would not kill a man, of course, unless we killed him to save him." And we have those amongst us that are full of all manner of abominations. Those who need to have their blood shed, for water will not do. Their sins are of too deep a dye. The guy really liked his blood atonement.
He really did. And you know who else did? Bill Hickman.
Well, yeah, but that guy was really more about doing the atoning than preaching it.
That's true. But because I'm a woman who loves Southern Utah frontier Mormon history the very best, I insist we should talk today about some of Utah's famous Southerners and their experiences in Nauvoo.
We get it. You know a lot about John D. Lee. Your medal is in the mail.
I do know a lot about John D. Lee. Thank you, Juanita Brooks. Do you know he was famous for being good at sex with the ladies? He was said to be good with his hands, too. Is that saying too much? Sorry if we scandalize some of you out there. But what if I told you that I wasn't making that up, that one of the people that helped perpetuate this rumor about John D. Lee was our dear prophet Brigham Young?
Yeah, Brigham, he was a crude dude. People really understand just how crass he could be.
I'm sure you have a shirt about that.
Boy, I hope it's in the Deseret Alphabet.
Yeah, Brigham was a man of the frontier. And what's weird is that when I've seen Brigham Young depicted in like Western films, they always depict him as pious, but he was not a pious man, at least not in the traditional sense. Did you see him in the show Hell on Wheels?
I haven't, but I know from talking to you, that's the AMC one where they make up the wonky plot about Brigham.
Yeah, and I don't want to like give any spoilers, but it bums me out because I thought the actor that they chose was fine. He like looked like him and everything, but the writing was kind of bad here. They make up this ridiculous plot that was flat and scandalous in a way that doesn't really fit. And that's what's so disappointing. Like, it's not like there's not great stuff to go on. The real history is way better than what you could make up. So honestly, the closest thing to Brigham Young that I've seen depicted in TV is Al Swearengen from HBO's Deadwood. Anyone that watches Deadwood knows what I'm talking about. The only difference between Al and Brig was that Brigham was a Massachusetts man, but he certainly didn't have Massachusetts manners, if you know what I mean. Those guys were always being crass with one another. They were swearing. They were talking about women. They were spitting tobacco. It was not a pious, like, preacher.
Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about. Locker room talk.
Yeah, exactly. But this is why I'm talking about these guys. They disrupt the idea of what men were, that these Mormon men were some pious Quakers, you know? I mean, some of them actually used to be pious Quakers and converted to Mormonism, but seriously, Mormon piety doesn't look the same now as it did then. I think John D. Lee is such a good example of this. I really want to talk about him. Also, dudes like William H. Dame and Isaac C. Haight and, hell, even Bishop Warren Snow, the castrator in Manti.
All right, calm down here. Can we talk at least about one pious guy?
Which pious man do you have in mind?
You know, what about Heber C. Kimball? I mean, he's a huge figure in the frontier period, but where does Heber get his start? What's he up to in Nauvoo?
Well, he's probably up to being boring and being a terrible husband like he would in the Utah period.
Zing! Yeah, you're actually right. I mean, we know a lot about him because he wasn't just being a terrible husband in Nauvoo. He was also giving his 14-year-old daughter in marriage with Joseph Smith, like we talked about. And I suppose we already mentioned him a little in our first Nauvoo polygamy episode. All right, so what about John Taylor? He was there. He was a big man in Nauvoo.
Are you choosing John Taylor as an example of piety? Like, he's the fundamental superhero. When I think of piety, I don't think of, like, dressing up in costumes and hiding in houses from the feds.
You'll change your tune when we get to 1886. Okay, fine. All right, what if we highlight some ladies? What was Emmeline B. Wells doing in Nauvoo? You know? Wait, we don't know. Because we only know her later, when she's the suffragist, she's the writer, she's the Relief Society president.
Yeah, I would really like to talk about her, and she's a Massachusetts woman herself, with, in fact, Massachusetts manners, for what it's worth. If we talk about her, let's talk about Bathsheba Smith, too, because everyone's always talking about her pompous husband, George A., but she's the real gem of the family.
All right, excellent. Let's start with her, then. We'll highlight her. We'll highlight John D. Lee, since both of them have experience with the secret polygamy there in Nauvoo. So Bathsheba Wilson Bigler Smith was born in 1822, which puts her in her early 20s for the Nauvoo period.
Wait, can I interject and say something about her name for a second? Because Bathsheba was really sentimental, and I like this about her. Apparently, the Wilson part of her name, so Bathsheba Wilson Bigler Smith, comes from when she was a child, and she traded names with a best friend as a token of true friendship. I think that's very Victorian and sweet.
Much better than a friendship ring. So on July 25th, 1841, Bathsheba marries a Mormon missionary, George A. Smith. Remember, the A stands for Albert. And this is a little confusing. You have to remember he also has a grandson who goes by, he's later church president, he goes by George Albert. So we call OG George Albert, George A, to keep them separate. Anyway, George A, he's just a little tyke. He's the youngest Mormon apostle at the time. He's also Joseph Smith's cousin, obviously, the founder of Mormonism. So these two vintage lovebirds met when George A. had tracked it into the Bigler home in West Virginia, where my peoples are from, interestingly. So Bathsheba was 15 at the time that she gets engaged to George. So they liked those teenagers, those missionaries. So when the Bigler family moves to Nauvoo with the Saints in 1840, George is still over in England on a mission. So Bathsheba had to wait several months till he gets home, and then they get married. So she's 19 when they finally tie the knot.
Let's talk about how the LDS Church's history site describes Bathsheba. They say, quote, Bathsheba's exodus with the saints from Nauvoo was part of the pattern of sacrifice and obedience that characterized the 88 years of her life. Her strongest talents lay in her ability at the loom with the needle, and her strongest character traits lay in her devotion to her husband, family, and the gospel. Bathsheba witnessed many remarkable events in the early history of the church. For example, not long after her family's arrival at Far West, a battle occurred at nearby Crooked River. Elder David W. Patton of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles was mortally wounded and was brought to the house where her family was staying. She witnessed his death a few days later. At age 19 in Nauvoo, Bathsheba was among the youngest present at the organization of the Relief Society in March 1842. She also attended the laying of the cornerstone of the Nauvoo Temple. Bathsheba and her husband, George A. Smith, were among the first to receive their temple endowments and be sealed together. After the prophet Joseph Smith was martyred, Bathsheba was present when the mantle of the presidency fell upon Brigham Young. Having experienced these and so many other landmark events, she lived appropriately enough in the historian's office in Salt Lake City. Her husband was church historian, end quote.
And what's interesting about her is that she really was with the church for so many of these pivotal events. Her family follows the saints from Missouri to Nauvoo, where, like Lindsay mentioned, she was one of the 20 women who found the Relief Society. Her family helps build the temple, and then she's in this small sacred circle of women who get their ordinances, the anointed quorum that we've talked about. So Bathsheba was anointed by Emma Smith and then received her endowment from Joseph Smith. So then also she and George are part of this early elite group that practices polygamy. So she's the first wife, and then George A. would marry Lucy Masserve and Nancy Clement on November 29, 1844, Zilpha Stark, March 26, 1845, Sarah Ann Libby on November 20th, 1845, and then her sister, Hannah Libby, on January 26th, 1846. Then in the Utah period, they welcomed Suzanne Elizabeth West in 1857. So if you're keeping track, all but one of those polygamous marriages happens in Nauvoo.
Side note, I know we're talking about Bathsheba, but let's talk about the two Libby sisters for a minute that George A. married and, you know, became sister wives to Bathsheba. Hannah and Sarah Ann Libby grew up working in clothing mills from age 12, which made them especially adept at weaving and child labor. They both helped weave the carpets for the Provo Tabernacle, which I think is really cool. But even more interesting is the fact that before they married George A., they were married to Joseph Smith's rascally brother, William Smith, the one that was busted for living spiritual wifery in Boston without church permission, which we've sort of touched on, but we will probably talk more about William Smith later. William Smith was exed in October of 1845, and it looks like just a month after he's exed, the Libby sisters are married to George A. as plural wives. It's through Sarah Libby's line that the future church president George Albert Smith, not to be confused with OG George A., would be born.
And I always wonder, in those later generations, if the William Smith period ever got talked about. I'm going to guess no.
I mean, William Smith is definitely good looking, but he was probably not great. They were probably looking for an out.
Yeah, I'm guessing he was a little too
violent.
Okay. Violent.
Yeah, that works too.
All of those. So back to Bathsheba. So here's what she had to say about plural marriage in her autobiography. Quote, "In the spring of 1843, Missouri renewed her wicked persecutions. Brother Joseph was arrested in Lee County, Illinois, while on a visit to his wife's relations. Great efforts were made by his brethren at Nauvoo to obtain his release. At a great expense of time and means, he was brought to Nauvoo and there discharged under a writ of habeas corpus. In this year, 1843, my husband went east on a mission, going as far as Boston, preaching and attending conferences by the way. He returned in the fall. My son, George Albert," quick timeout, yes, this is a third George Albert, "had been sick all summer, which caused me great anxiety. He was now a little better. Soon after my husband's return, we were blessed by receiving our endowments and were sealed under the holy law of celestial marriage, which was revealed July 12, 1843. Another side note, yes, celestial marriage, but kind of the plural kind. "I heard the prophet Joseph charge the 12 with the duty and responsibility of administering the ordinances of endowment and of sealing for the living and the dead. I met many times with Brother Joseph and others who had received their endowments in company with my husband in an upper room dedicated for that purpose and prayed with them repeatedly in those meetings. I heard the prophet give instructions concerning plural marriage. He counseled the sisters not to trouble themselves in consequence of it, that all would be right and the result would be for their golden exaltation."
She also said this, quote, "Being thoroughly convinced, as well as my husband, that the doctrine of plurality of wives was from God, and having a fixed determination to attain to celestial glory, I felt to embrace the whole gospel, and that it was for my husband's exaltation that he should obey the revelation on celestial marriage, that he might attain to kingdoms, thrones, principalities, and powers, firmly believing that I should participate with him in all his blessings, glory, and honor. Accordingly, within the year, like Sarah of old, I had given to my husband five wives, good, virtuous, honorable young women, This gave them all homes with us, being proud of my husband and loving him very much, knowing him to be a man of God and believing he would not love them less because he loved me more. I had joy in having a testimony that what I had done was acceptable in my Father in heaven, end quote. I think it's interesting that she says she loves that he loved her the best. That's how she made sense of it, because that's a no-go in polygamy. I mean, it happens. Everyone has a favorite, they say, but you're not supposed to say that you have a favorite.
Don't say it out loud. You say that in your head.
So one of the things I don't think a lot of people know about Bathsheba is she was also a gifted artist and kept sketches of church leaders in her diary. So there's this very famous one of the profile picture of Joseph Smith, which most Mormons have likely seen but didn't realize it was attributed to her. It's of Joseph Smith facing left with a dark coat and a cravat, holding a book with his hair slicked back and his nose arched. But they say she was like the most gifted with her needlework and on the loom, and she had this particular gift for making beautiful cloth. So I'm sure her and her sister wives had that in common.
Bathsheba would go on to become the fourth General Relief Society president. Although we usually hear more about her husband George than her, big surprise, we kind of don't like to talk about the women in Mormon history. But she had a very remarkable life. She served in the Nauvoo Temple as a priestess, and then later a temple worker in Logan for 17 years.
Yeah, that's right. She served as second counselor for a while until 1901, when she was called as general president of the Relief Society, which was a calling she held until her death in 1910. And hopefully when we get into the later periods, we can talk about her tenure there. So she saw the completion of the Relief Society building completed a year before her death. And during her tenure, she helped establish an employment bureau for women that taught them nursing and domestic skills. She was also, I think, on the board of the hospital for women there. So she was really involved, and we'll talk more about that. But Bathsheba died in 1910 and is buried in the Salt Lake City Cemetery. And I'm told that her funeral was also the first woman's funeral to be held in the Salt Lake Tabernacle. So yay for equality.
And George had died in 1875. So she lives a solid 35 years doing all this amazing stuff. And we don't have to hear about George for those 35 years. So yay for equality. And her story is really interesting because it's this conundrum of secret polygamy in Nauvoo at the beginning. You have these smart, educated, very prominent women in the community who are all being inducted into what is essentially this secret sexual society where women are given to different men. But not just that, the story of the Libby sisters being sold first to William Smith and then George A. Smith, his cousin, really showcases the messiness and fluidity of this system at the time.
Yeah, and I want to point that out as we start talking about polygamy. Pay attention, especially if you're a modern LDS person. We have some things that change the dynamic of celestial marriage for us than it did for our ancestors. First of all, we have penicillin. We have modern medicine that keeps us alive a lot longer. So you'll be married to your spouse at 18 or 19 in the LDS temple and go on to live in your 90s. Early Mormons weren't like that. They were dying younger. They were getting sealed, resealed, moving around. So they had multiple sexual partners, not just the men in polygamy, but it's ignored. Women did too. They were often resealed like these Libby sisters. But I'm just glad we talked about Bathsheba at all because I think she's wildly underappreciated in Mormonism. When I drove down to St. George, in St. George, they have Brigham Young's winter home, and they have, trees with cotton and they tell you about the cotton and the trees and the weaving, and they have a picture of Bathsheba in the house, but they don't quote the project, the weaving project with her. They quote her husband, George A., and they leave Bathsheba out of it. And we hear a lot about her husband, and I remember pointing out, hey, that's Bathsheba on the wall. And the sweet elderly sister missionary was like, oh, is it? I was like, yeah, that's like the fourth General Relief Society president. How do you not know who that is? And it was just kind of sad to me she didn't know.
All right, back to work. We're getting on in this. We've only talked about one person so far.
I'm glad we're doing several of these because there are so many interesting characters to talk about, all of who are doing things in the Nauvoo period, and it would later shape church history.
Yep. So if you understand what they're doing in Nauvoo, it'll help you understand how Mormonism develops later on. So it's time to make Lindsay's night. Let's talk John D. Lee.
Hey, I've been waiting. It's always a good night when I get to talk about Southern Utah Mormonism. It's my most favorite thing because studying Juanita Brooks means I have a very detailed look at Lee. Brooks was famous for unearthing Mountain Meadows Massacre in so many ways, but it's also lesser known that she was the biographer of John D. Lee, and she transcribed all of his extant journals. Few people know him better than she did. That's like just from the historical record, that's absolutely true. So I'm really excited to talk about him. He's really mostly known for the massacre, but you should all know more about his early life if you want to understand how the church was being shaped, because he actually really comes into play later on as an important character.
John Doyle Lee. He's born in 1812 in Kaskaskia, Illinois. Illinois at that point's a new territory, just 3 years old. The family would brag that they were from the same Lee family of Robert E. Lee.
Nobody wants to brag about that now.
Yeah, that's not a brag you hear much anymore. So his mother is a survivor of this violent break-in that kills her first husband, mutilates her child. So when John D. is three, the mother deeds John and his sister to a man named George Fisher. We don't really know why, but we know his mom didn't have long to live. That may have been. The father was a heavy alcoholic, so not a great house to be in. So now this new family under George Fisher, Lee is raised by an enslaved nurse who spoke only French. And he's raised by her for 4 years. And then Lee goes to a different house under the care of James Connor, who is his uncle. And at this stop, he really struggles. And this is so interesting. I don't think most people know this. He only spoke French because he'd been raised by this woman that spoke French. And instead of being the only child to this black nurse who was undoubtedly giving him lots of attention, now he's just one more kid in this large, crazy house with lots of kids. And it really seems like he resented this. So his uncle, also an alcoholic, and his aunt, Charlotte, would physically abuse the children. He learns farm work here. He learns how to fish and hunt. So it's this kind of blend of the idyllic part of childhood, you know, this farm and hunting and fishing, and then going home to get abused. So not particularly fun blend. So at the age of 16, he leaves this home. And at this point, he's trying to find his godfather, William Morrison. And, you know, he wants a better life. He wants to forget this really crappy childhood he had and make it big. He never finds Morrison, and he ends up having to come home and he helps manage the farm. But when he gets back, he learns his uncle had taken another orphan cousin named Emily Connor.
Yeah, and Emily comes into play because the two develop a crush on each other. But, you know, John D. Lee, when we understand his role in the massacre, I think it's important to understand his very violent past. He grew up in a violent household with alcoholism. He was shuffled around as a kid, two abusive caretakers. And then he helps out fighting in a stint in the Black Hawk War of 1832, and he was only 20 years old. And it's kind of a small, like, war, but when he returns, he worked at another violent place, the Galena Mining Camp, where he learned to be a grocer and a bartender and a cook. If you know anything about mining camps, especially in this period, they were rough. They were made of lumbermen and miners who lived there and gambled and drank. That's all you could do. And so there were fights all the time. So one day, a man named Chance, who knows? I don't know. Described as the camp tough, which I love it when people call.
If you're a camp tough in a mining camp.
It's like a Jeremy Tucker or Kingston Frenny always calls it, the Carbon County Toughs is what he called the bad guys.
Yeah, when you're in a rough place and that's your identity, don't screw with that guy.
The camp tough gets into a drunken fight with Lee, and Lee apparently hurts him bad enough that he has to flee back to the farm and into the arms of his lady love and cousin, Emily. She was working at a tavern where Lee started to frequent so much that he lost nearly all of his money at the gambling tables. And because of this, Emily refused to marry Lee, and he refused to stop playing cards. He left Emily, headed to live with his sister in Vandalia, and that's where he met Agatha Ann Woolsey. They married on July 24th, 1833, and they had three kids. Two died, and then came a visit from Elder King, a Mormon missionary, with a strange new book. And from there, he and Agatha were hooked. They joined the Saints at Far West on June 4th, 1838, and were baptized shortly after. And it took the summer and some Missouri mob persecutions, and then Lee joined up with the new Mormon band of protectors, the Danites.
Of course, John D. Lee gets baptized at basically the most violent point in Mormon history.
I know. It's a theme. It's crazy, right?
Yep. Yeah, the Danites. Well, let's see what Lindsay Skrill Juanita has to say about them. Quote, a secret organization had been effected, which became known as the Danite Band. When William Swartzel was initiated on July 21st, he said there were many ahead of him. Joseph Allen Stout wrote the quote, mobs began to rise and commit depredations till we were forced to resort to arms in order to save ourselves and property. The church organized under captains, 10s, 50s, and 100s, and 1000s. They, the Missourians, called our organization the Danite Band. I belonged to the 3rd 50 led by Reynolds Cahoon, close quote. His brother, Hosea Stout, was also a member, evidently an officer. For years later, he wrote the quote, went on again performing as we rode some Danite evolutions of horsemanship as we practiced in the war in Davis County, Missouri in the fall of 1838, close quote. At another time, he noted the quote, after drilling a while, I took them through the old Missouri Danite drill, close quote.
So when I read about this in the biography that Juanita wrote on Lee, I was kind of shocked to realize how formal an organization it was, because I always were told that the Danites were just like a few ruffians with Bowie knives, right? Like, but no, they were practicing drills and quadrilles and all of these things. So yeah, Lee, of course, was probably attracted to this, joins the Danites, and this is still in Missouri. And the Mormons are all armed with heavy, sharp wooden clubs. This is how the Danites fought at the time. There's a violent scuffle that happens between a Missourian and a Mormon, and it turned into a violent brawl. And Lee says that John L. Butler gives the Danite sign of distress, which was, as Swartzel described, quote, placing the right hand to the right temple, the thumb behind the ear. And then he yelled, charge, Danites. After the brawl, the Mormons began their campaign of retaliation, which Lee was part of. So let's go back to what Brooks says. She says, quote, according to Swartzel, the Danites do not wait for retaliation, but began foraging the countryside, driving off cattle and carrying off loot of different kinds, justifying themselves with the thought that they were taking back only a small part of what had been robbed in Jackson County. David Patton led one group to Gallatin, scene of the election day, looted the store and set fire to the building, end quote.
Yeah, so much for peaceful protests.
Quote, back to Juanita, in other areas, they took honey, which they called sweet oil, hogs, which they called bear, and cattle, which they called buffalo. Weird quote, weird secret coding.
Boy, no one will ever guess what we're really talking about.
Oh no, you only stole bear? Why did you steal bear? Lee admitted that he had participated in some of these, but insisted that none of them did any of the burning or killing, though they did take cattle, bedding, foodstuffs, and guns, end quote. Yeah, this kind of shakes up the idea of persecuted Mormons in Missouri.
Well, don't you think it's so interesting that this early on, John D. Lee is already trying to downplay his involvement in things like this? No, 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 we didn't.
No,
do that.
We didn't take honey. We maybe took sweet oil.
Maybe a little sweet oil. I mean, yeah, who doesn't want some sweet oil?
And then we have the bloody battle of Crooked River, which I guess Christopher Smith was right. We should have talked more about Missouri, but it's a bloody battle with Mormons. And this is the same fight our Bathsheba was part of. When Patton is hurt, he basically bleeds out on her kitchen table. So Juanita continues, quote, during the 15 hours it took for David Patton to die, he retained consciousness and suffered excruciating pain. His death affected his companions profoundly. They thought, as he had, that he was immune to bullets. It broke the morale of the saints, for it gave them a glimpse of what war might actually become, end quote. Okay, I swear we're going to make it to Lee and Nauvoo. It's just that we sort of, historian Christmas, great disappointment, skipped over Missouri. Who knows? Maybe we'll come back to it later. Sorry, Chris, you're probably right. We should probably talk more about it.
Chris. We don't like, neither of us like Missouri. It's if you haven't figured that
we'll
out yet.
We'll get to it by talking about where were they now. That's what.
Yeah. So to really understand John D. Lee, I mean, you have to take account of how violent his life had been, you know, and that's something that child psychologists are really coming up with, this idea, you know, how if you have more of these certain kinds of, remind me,
trauma,
the acronym that that Shirley talks about.
ACEs.
There we go. Thank you.
Shirley Draper,
yes.
Working for the FLDS community.
Yes.
Give all your money to Cherish Family. She's great.
And I know about this because I went to Sunstone.
Ah.
So this idea of the more of these traumatic childhood experiences you have, that affects your later life. John D. Lee is the poster child for this, literally. So as he grows up, he's shifted around as a young child. He's physically abused. Then he fights as a soldier. He works at a mining camp. And then when he gets to Mormonism, he doesn't get, you know, quiet, happy Mormonism. He gets Danite Mormonism. So, you know, he joins these other Mormons who were imprisoned because they'd been involved at the skirmish at Crooked River. And then he's ordained to the Mormon priesthood by Joseph Young and Levi Hancock. And then he's given a patriarchal blessing by Isaac Morley. And pay attention to this, because as we talk about him later in the Utah period, and especially Mountain Meadows, these few details here will give you additional insight into that event and these people that are involved. So Isaac Morley gives him a blessing, and like I said, it'll show up later in this massacre history. He promises John D. Lee that he would preach the gospel to thousands. He would have numerous posterity, you know, standard blessing, yada, yada, understand the hidden things of heaven. But then it also promises, quote, "Thou shalt come forth in the morning of the first resurrection, and no power shall hinder except the shedding of innocent blood or consenting thereto." Huh. Interesting that that shows up in his blessing.
Yeah, let's let Juanita explain it. She does it so well. She says, quote, "The promise that he should come forth on the morning of the first resurrection and, quote, no power shall hinder except the shedding of innocent blood or consenting thereto, was the one which many years later would cause him the most agony of soul. The sentence appears to have become a part of the temple ordinance in the Nauvoo Temple. For 8 years later, in February 1846, George Lobb, describing his experiences in the temple, wrote, quote, "And we was sealed up to eternal life to come forth in the morning of the first resurrection. Only the sinning against the Holy Ghost, which is the shedding of innocent blood, or consenting to the same," end quote. Although this was pronounced upon all who went through the temple, Lee at the end felt the weight of it so keenly that he was able to face a firing squad, secure in the belief that by giving his own life, he would atone for the violation of this one condition, which would endanger his status in the hereafter, end quote. And of course, she's talking about he takes the fall for the Mountain Meadows Massacre and is killed by firing squad.
And then falls into his coffin. That's, it would be more difficult, it'd be really hard to come up with a more Wild West scene.
I know.
They shoot him into his coffin. And we have pictures of him sitting on his coffin.
He was ready for it. And maybe it's this, one of the brilliant things that Juanita Brooks gives credit for, and I hope we talk about this later, is she looks at the patriarchal blessings of all these massacre guys and sees what they were promised and how it influenced their role in the massacre, which I think is important.
Mormons take those pretty seriously. So like his blessing had promised, he did this. He served a mission. He goes all over the southern states. I mean, that's most of his early journals are just missionary accounts. Then he, his wife, and his child go to Nauvoo, and they arrive in April 1840. And, you know, it's supposed to be this refuge on the banks of the river after the violence of Nauvoo. You know, if somebody lost their home in Far West, they were given a free lot in Nauvoo. Lee, who had his cabin burned down, gets a piece of land on Warsaw Street, and actually his house there is still standing, which is
kind Did you
fun.
See it when you were in Nauvoo? Do you remember?
I don't remember. I don't think so.
I would like to go. I still haven't been to Nauvoo. We've That's done since right. Nauvoo. I know, it's crazy. I plan to. Locke, I will get there. Okay. All right. As promised at the beginning of the episode, I made an inference that Lee had a reputation with the ladies.
Oh, and you more than inferred.
I don't say this to be crude, but to explain the early Mormon saints were not as Puritan as our movies and family histories would like us to believe. Especially because Mormons, especially modern Mormons today, are so obsessed with like sex and modesty, you know, like this would have been shocking. Juanita writes, quote, "Women especially responded to him," John D. Lee, "as the number who later followed him to Nauvoo gives evidence," end quote. Apparently, Lee was very charismatic. He was invited to many homes for dinner, to debate ministers, to even get an education for free. Women would sew him clothes for free. They would thank him for like being able to sew his underwear and his pants. And then he was famous for this. Like he would thank them by writing acrostic verses, which if you don't know what that is, it's basically like a poem where the first letter of each line spells something. And Brett Metcalf would knew you'd make that joke. It's funny because, well, I mean, it's not funny, but later on, Brett Metcalf, a historian, friend of the podcast, Sunstoner, we love him. John Whitmer Historical Association, if you haven't supported them, look them up. But he had an acrostic written to him by, was it Midgley? Who was it?
Yeah, it's such a great story. It's in the Farm's Review of Books, a quote.
This is modern now. We're talking about what year is this? 90s?
92, yeah, I think.
1990s.
Yeah, it was a joke that just coincidentally happened to make it to publication. Yeah. So yeah, Dancy Peterson and Midgley and John D. Lee all...
What was the acrostic? Would you like to say what they called Brent Metcalf?
Yeah, Metcalf is butthead.
They spelled butthead and they let it through a publication.
Grown
most of it.
Professors are doing this.
I know. Well, John D. Lee would do it, but to thank the ladies, he would write them acrostic poem, which I'm sure only helped him in their eyes. Here's what Brooke says. She says, quote, "The women who mended his socks and underwear, embroidered his vest, and tailored his suit were all more fond of him as a result, sewing their affections in with every stitch." End quote. Gross. Because of this charm, he baptized a lady of the first estate, Mrs. Caroline Gilliam, who brought her large estate of 15 grand to Mormonism, and she was baptized. But strangely, her husband didn't join her.
We should do an episode just on these rich women who donate all their money. We talked about the Vose women in Boston and the,
oh, yeah,
the furniture ladies. I mean, this is Vienna Jakes at multiple points donates a lot of money.
Everyone should watch The Vow.
Rich ladies getting it done. So,
can I just say something? I'm sorry to keep talking about the HBO's Vow. I think I talked about it on Polygamy episode, but I wrote this script and the endowment ceremony while watching HBO's The Vow, and it was like not on purpose. It just coincided, and I was like, oh my gosh, I see the parallels everywhere. So sorry about that.
Lindsay's been playing a lot of volleyball lately. A lot of volleyball. So John D. Lee is on a mission during this parade they have in Nauvoo in May. And in the, you know, it wasn't just throwing candy. Joseph Smith, John C. Bennett ride side by side. They have the whole Nauvoo Legion, 26 companies, 2,000 men. I mean, this was huge. So during this parade, they were supposed to have this sham battle. You know, they're all 12 years old at heart still. And
look how powerful we are. Look how strong and forceful, yeah, our military.
The Nauvoo Legion was a very good way to act out their unfulfilled 12-year-old dreams. They got swords and uniforms. it was a big deal to them. So anyways, the sham battle goes south, and it's so hard because this is after John C. Bennett is no longer welcome. They accuse him like he tried to engineer the sham battle to actually kill Joseph Smith. Who knows? This smells more like throwing him under the bus, but something happens. Bennett gets excommunicated, and you know, he loses his position as mayor, all these other titles he has. And then Joseph Smith kind of steps in and takes over all these roles. However, John D. Lee does get back into town in time for the excommunication meeting where Bennett gets stripped of all these titles. And if you remember from the John C. Bennett episode, it was a lot of titles.
Well, and I didn't know that. I didn't know John D. Lee was a guy like escorting these guys out. That was like his job. He's the bouncer of Mormonism.
Yeah. If I remember right, he's the one keeping the Legion record at that time. He's a scribe.
Have beautiful handwriting. I'll give Juanita Brooks that.
We think of him of Mountain Meadows only, but yeah, he was a writer.
He was. He loved to write and record everything he did, yeah, including acrostics.
Yeah, underwear acrostics.
Lee loved the social life in Nauvoo almost as much as he loved baptizing the ladies. He attended choral concert, dances, sociables, and played Saturday afternoon baseball. I don't think I realized that. And I'm writing an episode script, I don't know if we'll ever finish it, on like the theater and the arts and the sports in Nauvoo, because you never hear about that kind of stuff. So when Joseph Smith was captured in June of 1843, this caused a huge stir in Nauvoo, and that coupled with a desire to maybe leave Nauvoo and settle beyond the Rocky Mountains, the Council of 50 is organized, and we're going to talk a lot more about that. But shortly after the secret doctrine that Joseph had been practicing, known as plural marriage, gets introduced, all of this goes south. So Joseph Smith had begun to slowly introduce the practice, and on May 5th, 1842, Brigham Young and Heber C. Kimball get introduced to polygamy. And of course, we've talked about this already. But on April 1st, 1843, Benjamin F. Johnson finds out. On April 11th, 1843, Erastus Snow was taught the doctrine, and Lorenzo Snow and John Benbow and his wife Jane learned the same month, and on and on and on. And so I just bring that up because it continues to break down the conspiracy that Joseph wasn't practicing plural marriage in Nauvoo. William Clayton, Joseph's trusted scribe who wrote down everything to Joseph's dismay, probably. He didn't burn all the letters. Who learned about the practice more than a year earlier, married Margaret Moon as his second wife on April 27, 1843. And it's that next July on the 12th that Hiram Smith reads the revelation to Emma Smith, which she then destroys. Then, of course, the document is read at the High Council on August 12, 1843, but it doesn't go really well. It's not well received. And people get pissed and they start defecting a Nauvoo expositor, et cetera, et cetera. Fun times at Nauvoo High. We're going to talk about all of that.
Back to John Dee. Here's another snippet from Juanita Brooks, quote, "When John Dee Lee arrived in Nauvoo just at this time, mid-August 1843, he found the city full of new homes and public buildings. The Masonic Temple, we mean the 70s Hall, was almost ready for dedication. The arsenal was completed and in use. The walls of the temple were up to the second story. Lee was at once restored to his place in the guard under his old friend Albert P. Rockwood. From this group, he learned of the Council of 50 with its inner circle, who are known as the Living Constitution, the executors of the law. So then, that same year, December 1843, they organize a secret police force to guard Joseph Smith. Legal challenges are growing. Internal dissent is growing. We've talked about this. Nauvoo is starting to get really, really chaotic. And Lee is number 7 out of 40. You know, Mormons love, oh yeah, my ancestor was a bodyguard of Joseph Smith. There were actually bodyguards. The chances that your ancestor was are probably not great, but there were at least 40 of these guys. So he's guarding Joseph Smith. He's part of this force. He's helping to build the 70s Hall, and which is actually where the Council of 50 would sometimes hold their meetings.
But secret councils and police and bodyguards couldn't stop the presses. Word was getting out about this secret polygamy thing, which both our girl Bathsheba and John Dee Lee were participating in.
And if you're a non-Mormon, you'd be a little freaked out with what's going on. The Masons have exploded. They have the biggest lodge in the state. The Nauvoo Legion is all of a sudden 4,000 guys. They like to march down the streets. They're parading their swords and guns. You know, to them, it's patriotic. It's, you know, it builds brotherhood.
But you've heard about these scary Mormons. Now they come to Nauvoo. They double their size, and now they're marching all the time with their sabers.
Mormon self-perceptions and how the rest of Illinois and the country saw them, a little bit different. Oh, yeah, then we have to throw polygamy into it. And, the neighbors are getting concerned. And so Joseph Smith is like, let's run for president. No one else will protect us. I'm going to have to do it. Because, yeah, that's not going to concern people either. So as, of course, Joseph Smith is killed, Lee is again on a mission. If you were good at being a missionary, you were constantly on missions. So the news slowly trickles out. So sometimes people came home immediately, but like others, Lee prays, he doesn't believe it. It's fake news. And there had been earlier reports that Joseph Smith had been killed when he really wasn't. So, you know, the news traveled slowly. It was inconsistent. So he claims an angel visited him without a flaming sword, tells him it was actually true, but that he should stay on his mission. So he stays out longer, baptizes a few more folks, and then finally does come back to Nauvoo.
And we're going to keep talking about Lee's charm and his attraction, because I think that's important, especially when you realize that Brigham Young wasn't as attractive to the ladies as someone like John Dee Lee. He was good looking. People liked him. He was well spoken. He was a Virginia man, which, you know, considered genteel and at the time and very educated and things like that. He spoke French. And so he's off on missions a lot, which shows that probably they needed John Dee Lee for the thuggin' and mobbin', but then they wanted him to go convert the ladies. That's kind of my opinion on it. So Lee would be gone when Sidney Rigdon and Brigham Young met in front of 8,000 people to contend for the leadership after Smith's death. This is a famous thing. We're going to talk about this plenty But the famous meeting where many are, you know, hear the voice of Joseph Smith when Brigham Young spoke, and they realize that Brigham Young is supposed to be the next leader of the church. Lee shows up 10 days after this, and he I think makes the best choice of his Mormon career. He accepts the transfer power to Brigham Young, and he supports Brigham Young more than ever. He becomes a close friend of Brigham Young's and almost immediately is put in positions of authority under Brigham Young. And this is where Lee gets inducted into the super secret polygamy club. Apparently, he wasn't as trusted by Joseph to be introduced into the practice, but Brigham was all about John D. Lee. Lee writes about this twice in his journal. And of course, it's important, his relationship to Brigham Young. This comes up later on. He writes about this one right after the other. This is what he says, quote, "About this time, my family began to increase by the law of adoption. February 5th, 1844, which we think is 1845. It's a mistake. Nancy Bean was adopted into my family. April 19th, 1845, Louisa Free was also admitted, taking upon her my name. On the same day, Caroline Williams was registered on my list. And on the third day of May 1845, Abigail Woolsey and Rachel, her daughter, was likewise acknowledged, Friday the 3rd, May at 7 p.m. He later gives details about this in his famous confession. He says, quote, "My second wife, Nancy Bean, was the daughter of a wealthy farmer who lived near Quincy, Illinois. She saw me on a mission and heard me preach at her father's house. She came to Nauvoo and stayed at my house 3 months and grew in favor and was sealed to me in the winter of 1845. My third and fourth wives were sealed to me soon after in my own house. Amasa Lyman officiated the ceremony. At the same time, Sarah C. Williams, a girl that I had baptized in Tennessee when but a child, stood up and claimed a place in my family." There you go. "In the spring of 1845, Rachel Endora was sealed to me. She was a sister to my first wife. Her mother, Abigail Schaefer, was sealed to me in an eternal state." Gosh, he gets introduced to the principal and doesn't waste any time. And now is maybe the time that you want to take the kids out of the room, because we're going to be getting into a little bit more detail about that.
It's an F word, but it's a different F word. So right away, as the system goes in Nauvoo usually, Lee, he's been introduced to polygamy. He then starts introducing the practice to others. So he inducts Hosea Stout, fellow tough guy, to the polygamy party. Lee finishes the work on building the 70s hall. And it Nauvoo, for a time, kind of calms down. Joseph Smith is dead, but Brigham Young has taken over. It's kind of gone back to normal. They're completing the temple. The music hall has fancy concerts. The Quorum of the Twelve, the other church authorities were, quote, "provided with much beer, wine, cakes, etc., as much as we could eat and drink," Lee wrote.
Wait, Quorum of the Twelve were drinking wine and beer? What?
Etc.
Etc. Okay. There's cake involved. That's Mormon food now.
Yeah. Etc. is probably funeral potatoes. So, but then things go sour. By September 1845, the mobbers are back. We're doing Missouri over again. We're burning Mormon houses. We're pulling everybody back to Nauvoo. The handwriting's on the wall. Mormons knew they would have to leave. They start making preparations. They're making wagons. And Lee is called to hurry up and finish the temple. And this is so interesting. In the last episode where we talked about the Devery Anderson and Gary Bergera's book on the Nauvoo endowment companies, John D. Lee is there all the time. He's a scribe. He, as we read there, sometimes he spends the night in the temple. He sleeps on one of the sofas there in the side room. And
they called it Sophia. Is that the same?
I assume, yeah. It's just like a couch.
Yeah.
Chilling there. And you have to think he's zealous, whatever he does, but you have to think that his enthusiasm to finish the temple maybe had something to do with he wants all these bajillion wives sealed to him and get their endowment. So in December 1845, Lee takes Nancy Bean, who was 8 months pregnant, and Rachel, and they get their endowments. And over the course of the next 2 months, then all the other wives also get their endowment.
So Brooks writes, quote, "At this time, another ceremony was instituted, which, though it was of short duration and never widely practiced, was significant and important while it lasted. This was the adoption of young men and their wives to one of the leaders. The idea behind it was that in establishing the kingdom of God upon the earth, there should also be a celestial relationship. if the prophet Joseph were to become a god over a minor planet, he must not only have a large posterity, but able assistance of practical skills. Brigham Young had been sealed to Joseph under this law. Now, in turn, he had some 38 young men sealed to him. Of this number, John D. Lee was second.
And this is a big deal for the rest of John D. Lee's life. He's the adopted son of Brigham Young. And after Mountain Meadows
comes into play,
he tries to play that card and Brigham shuts him down. So, yeah, this period of adoption is fascinating. It's a spiritual MLM, we'll say. We get these guys sealed to us on our down line.
But that's how it worked, yeah.
It creates problems because, obviously Brigham Young has tons of dudes sealed to him. And then, you know, then Heber C. Kimball has a little bit less and so on. And Wilford Woodruff writes about this in his journal, and he sees that they're competing for this, and these family tribes are organized. They have meetings, and it's a very odd, like Juanita says, didn't last very long, but it was a little weird.
And apparently Lee was disappointed that he was sealed as a second wife, the second adopted son, and not the first. Apparently the sealing order mattered to some of these men, and sometimes jealousies crept up. Lee had around 18 or 19 dudes and their wives adopted him, most of them people he had brought into the church or baptized. He sometimes referred to a few, including some of them, and I'll name them so you know who was sealed to Lee. Thomas Woolsey, W.M. J. Phelps. Is that William J. Phelps?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
William J. Phelps. George Lobb Lee, W.B. Owens Lee, Miles Anderson Lee, James Pace Lee, Alan Weeks Lee, William Swap Lee. And I'm saying Lee because he uses their surname Lee. So it would have been, you know, William J. Phelps Lee, because he's sealed to John D. Lee.
And wasn't it so interesting when he was talking about his plural wives, he used that adoption language. They were adopted to him and then took on his name. There really is this kind of erasure of gender in adoption, where, you know, men are sealed to men, and the language of women being adopted to men is so similar. It's a very, this period is so fascinating.
And there are some discussions, and we won't get into this because it's mostly speculative, but I'll plant the seed of, you know, people are like, oh, well, Joseph Smith is sealing men and women to each other. Yeah, but I mean, I do think that if you were homosexual or had inclinations at the time, I mean, that they didn't see the word homosexual. That wasn't invented until later. But if you had those feelings, this might have made sense of that. So that's one explanation to why some men saw adoption as the same thing. But we really don't know. What we do know is that Lee relished this practice. It meant a lot to him. He was there on December 3rd when Parley P. Pratt would read from John C. Freeman's journal, where they began to figure out their route to head west. So that's kind of a crucial part. So why don't we talk about the crude parts now? Now take your kids out of the room because we are going to get friggin' weird.
Wait, we haven't talked about him already?
No, it gets worse. I mean, I promised at the beginning that John D. Lee was known to be good with the ladies. Here's what Will Bagley says in Blood of the Prophets. He says, quote, in late 1845, Lee was engaged to marry the gentle and beautiful Louisa Free and her sister, Emmeline. One day, Brigham Young saw Emmeline and fell in love with her. Lee recalled, he promised that if Lee would surrender the girl, he would uphold Lee in time and eternity, and he never should fail, and he would sit at Young's right hand in the kingdom. The request tormented Lee, for he loved Emmeline dearly, but he agreed to resign his claim in Young's favor. Emmeline became one of Young's favorite wives and bore him 10 children, but the bargain ignited an odd reaction in the explosive Lee. He later boasted to George Grant he had frigged Louisa Free 20 times in one night. Grant did not believe him, but Lee, quote, called God and angels to witness that he told the truth. Grant told Lee he was a bigger fool than Grant thought he was if he would allow his arse to run away with his head. That's the direct quote. Undeterred, Lee claimed, quote, he went home after frigging so often and frigged all the women he had in his house. Lee, Grant testified, believed he had the devil in him. So just so we're clear, Lee is frigging all of his wife so much he has the devil in him. And of course, Chris Smith is going to go into the story a little bit more in just a minute.
Frigging. And you just thought that was a Provo curse word. No, It has a more colorful history than that, but... So here's what Mike Quinn writes. Joseph E. Johnson privately told a group of devout Mormons in 1850, quote, he was familiar with the first frigging that was done in his house with his mother-in-law by Joseph Smith. So this is interesting, this is where some of the lesser known or possible plural wives of Joseph Smith or straight up affairs come into play. So
there was frigging involved. That's all we know.
There was some frigging going on. Johnson said this during a council meeting that was deciding whether to excommunicate him for impregnating one of Apostle Lorenzo Snow's plural wives, whom Johnson now wanted to marry. She loved him, not the apostle. A church court in Canesville, Iowa, had already decided that, quote, his priesthood was required to be laid down, i.e. he's disfellowshipped, until he came here to Salt Lake City. And we bring up Joseph Smith apparently frigging Mary Heron Snyder as an example of how the men talked about the stuff going on in Nauvoo. It's almost as good a phrase as celestializing with the maiden.
Almost. But yeah, Brigham once said in a council meeting that John D. Lee's problem was really that he was happy and frigged his women too much. Yikes. I mean, coming from the man who sealed a bunch of ladies all in one day, that's a lot. But this whole thing with Emily and Free was crazy. That's why they call me.
For today's episode, Lindsay asked me to talk about a disciplinary council in December 1847, at which John D. Lee was tried for various offenses, including verbal and physical abuse of his wives. The record of this disciplinary council is a little vague at some points, but I'm going to try to do my best to interpret it for you. I looked at a bunch of people's journals that I hoped might help clarify things, but coverage of this period is really spotty, and all I found were a couple short entries from Wilford Woodruff and Hosea Stout. The disciplinary hearing happened in what is now Florence, Nebraska. It was known at the time to Mormons as winter and then summer quarters, because it's where the Mormon pioneers stopped for the winter en route to Utah in 1846. And then in the spring of 1847, Brigham Young left winter quarters for Utah at the head of a pioneer vanguard company, but a lot of people stayed behind at what they now called summer quarters, which became a semi-permanent Mormon settlement and a way station for Mormon pioneers en route to Utah. Brigham Young, before leaving, had established a farm about 13 miles north of summer quarters. And he left his adopted son, John D. Lee, in charge of the farm. Young left instructions for Lee to divide the land fairly among his adopted sons, of which he had about 22. Lee took the prime 70 acres for himself, however, which was by far the largest parcel, and the remaining 105 acres were split between his 22 adopted sons. So far from an equal or equitable distribution of land. Lee's wives and adopted sons felt ill-used by him. His wife Polly Ann Workman behaved in what he considered a disobedient, unruly, and turbulent manner, unbecoming a woman. So he sent her away to go live with her brother as his housekeeper, and she never came back. Lee's adopted son, Tom Johnson, got tired of doing menial, poorly compensated labor for Lee and, quote, swore that he was not a-going to be a Negro for John D. Lee any longer, unquote. In August, Hosea Stout visited the farm and found Lee and most of his adopted son's families so ill that many of them couldn't even get out of bed, and they would have been fine because they had enough food on the farm, in Stout's opinion, if they were taking care of each other, but instead of taking care of each other, they were all quarreling and at each other's throats. In September, Lee got into a fight with Charles Kennedy, another of Brigham Young's adopted sons, and beat him badly. The fight was partly over Lee's young fiancée, Emmeline Free. I get the impression that Emmeline was unhappy with Lee and didn't really want to marry him, and so Charles Kennedy helped her get away. This is my theory. I'm mostly speculating here, but it seems to fit the facts. And Lee considered this an interference in his private family affairs, and so he beat the crap out of poor Charles Kennedy. A church court put Lee on trial for this, and ordered that he apologize to Kennedy and assume full blame for the incident. Lee resisted this, but eventually he gave in and parroted the words that were fed to him by the church council. But the council judged that he was insincere in this apology and resolved to take the matter up with Brigham Young when Young returned from the West. Young did return at the end of October, and apparently his solution to the fight over Emmeline was to marry Emmeline himself. Young told Lee that if he would give up Emmeline to him, he would uphold him in time and eternity, and he should never fall, but that he would sit at his right hand in his kingdom. Lee agreed to give Emmeline up on these conditions. That wasn't the end of it, though, because other church leaders felt that Lee's problematic management of his family went way deeper than just the thing with Emmeline. A lot of Lee's rage at his wives stemmed from their going away without his permission to visit their families. Lee forbade them to go do this because he was afraid that his wives would cheat on him the moment they got out from under his thumb. For instance, he told George D. Grant that one wife, quote, was a dirty little strumpet. What a great word. And if she went off to St. Louis or St. Joseph, where her brother was, that she would allow everybody to frig her. Another great word. And he would not take her when she came back. Lee also bragged to Grant about frigging Louisa Free 20 times in one night. And then he said he frigged all his other wives that night as well. When Grant said he didn't believe him, because this is not anatomically possible for a man, Lee swore to God and all the angels that it was true. Apparently this wasn't a one-off, because when Grant brought the matter before a church court, he said he could produce dozens of other witnesses who had heard Lee say similar things about frigging his wives. Joining Grant in bringing charges against Lee was Brigham Young's own brother, Joseph Young. The charges are not fully spelled out in the disciplinary hearing because, in Joseph Young's words, the matter was, quote, delicate. But Joseph Young presented letters from Lee's wives, Nancy Bean and Martha Berry, which were read to the council and alleged various kinds of misconduct by Lee. And the charges were serious enough that Joseph Young wanted Lee disfellowshipped if the charges were true. Lee swore to God and the angels that the greater part of the charges were false, and that enough lies had been told about him in Brigham Young's absence that if each lie were the size of a tobacco seed, they would fill the council house. Nancy Bean's complaints included the fact that Lee had forbidden her to go see her family, and Lee acknowledged that that was true, but he said he planned to take her for a visit next spring, and that she had been turbulent and treated him badly. It was also alleged that he had sent away his wife Caroline Williams. He denied having sent her away, but he said what happened was that she had misbehaved really badly and that he had invited her to leave and she had taken him up on the offer. He also denied Nancy Bean's allegation that he had kicked her and thrown a brickbat at her, though he admitted to striking her once with a switch. He was also supposed to have choked and switched another wife, but he denied that too. He accused Joseph Young and George D. Grant of persecuting him, of trying to destroy his influence, of taking pleasure in his suffering, and of trying to get Martha Berry away from him so that she could be sealed to Amasa Lyman. By the way, here's a pro tip. Whenever someone tells you that everyone else is lying about them and persecuting them and they're the only one telling the truth, that's what we call a red flag. Joseph Young and George D. Grant did not believe Lee's denials of the charges, and we can infer from their arguments what some of the other charges against Lee were. George D. Grant said that he could produce dozens of witnesses who had heard Lee brag about aggressively frigging his women. In Grant's opinion, Lee's sexual aggression showed that he was full of the devil. So probably the women had complained of sexual abuse. The charges definitely also included verbal abuse. According to Joseph Young, Martha Berry had complained, quote, that the language in your house is the same as a common strumpet house, calling every woman bitches, strumpets, and everything nasty about the privates. He has threatened to cut one of his women's throats and drove another out of his house, unquote. Martha Berry said that she would rather live in hell than live in Lee's house anymore. Apparently, some of the women also felt that Lee had tricked them into marrying him. Joseph Young said, Martha Berry told me it was through deception, and I know by the spirit of the Lord that Brother Lee got some of those women by fraud. In addition to the grievances of the wives, Lee's adopted sons resented him as well. George D. Grant had heard the men at the farm threatening to shoot one another up. Joseph Young felt these charges were serious enough to be a matter of salvation, but since Lee's salvation had been guaranteed through Mormon ritual, Joseph settled for making it a matter of fellowship instead. The fact that Lee denied charges, which were so well attested by so many witnesses, only made his sins look even worse and made him look even more deserving of punishment. Lee had replied to Joseph Young's charges by saying, "Who is Joseph Young?" Even though Joseph Young was one of the seven presidents of the 70 and Lee's direct superior in the church hierarchy, John D. Lee was himself a 70. Joseph Young had offered Lee a whole quorum of 70s to preside over on one occasion, but Lee refused to accept any church calling lower than an apostleship or a presidency. He believed he deserved something higher than a quorum of 70 to preside over. In Joseph Young's opinion, he is tyrannical, and no man got the big head more than he had, and all the sophistry he can make use of until sundown cannot make me believe otherwise. In addition to disfellowshipping, Brigham's brother suggested that Lee should be whipped and his family set at liberty to leave him if they wished. Albert Perry Rockwood, who was also present at the meeting, agreed with Joseph Young that Lee had the big head. At a church dance that Rockwood had presided over, Rockwood had made Lee leave the dance floor to make room for other people who wanted to dance, after dancing two successive figures of a Swedish folk dance called the Treting. When Rockwood drove Lee off the dance floor, Lee declared that had the law of God been put into execution, Rockwell's head should have been parted from his body for this outrage. At this point in the trial, Lee spoke up in response to Rockwood's allegation and said that his rage was justified because Rockwell's action had been part of a calculation to conspire against me. This is a man who had paranoid delusions that everyone was out to get him. Brigham Young had mixed feelings about all this. He wanted to support his adopted son, but he also wanted to support his brother, Joseph Young, who had brought these charges. And he admitted that he had trembled for his adopted son and that he felt the reproof was for Lee's good and came from the Holy Spirit. Brigham Young certainly believed that Lee had wronged his adopted sons by disregarding counsel to distribute land fairly on the farm. Young said, "I told him how to divide the land, but I understand Brother Lee took 70 acres for himself and sent other men a great way to cultivate just 2 acres. But while Brigham sympathized with the men who had been adopted as Lee's sons, he had little sympathy for the women that Lee had married as polygamous wives. Joseph Young's advocacy for the wives chafed against Brigham's misogyny. In Brigham's opinion, a man, quote, will tell you 99 truths to the woman telling one truth. They will lie in the name of the Lord and in their own name. They are dependent on men to save them." In other words, if Lee said one thing and his wives said another, then Brigham believed Lee, not the women. With regard to his treatment of his wives, Brigham said, "I have no reproof to give him." Lee's only problem was that he had, quote, loved his women too much and frigged them too much. Instead of whipping or disfellowshipping, Brigham proposed that Lee should just call a family meeting, he should promise not to use crass language when speaking about his wives anymore, and he should give his wives and son the option to be set at liberty from him if they wished. But he should also make clear that if they left, only sorrow awaited them for the crime of leaving a righteous man. And if they stayed, quote, they have either to turn round and hold their tongues or admit they are in the wrong. As women, as Brigham saw it, quote, if there is any wrong, it is in them and they have to bear it. Lee agreed to this course of action, not surprising because this was tremendously lenient given what Joseph Young had accused him of and called for as punishment. And 9 days later, the apostles approved a list of persons who wished to be released from John D. Lee. We don't have the actual list, but according to Hosea Stout's journal, 2 wives and almost all of his adopted sons stepped out of the family. The apostles thought this was for the best. Amissa Lyman declared that this would be a blessing and a learning experience for John D. Lee, and Heber C. Kimball prophesied that he will yet rise and do good. Lee was retained in full and warm fellowship with the church.
And that's a wrap. I mean, not for John D. Lee, but for his Nauvoo life. He heads west with his wives, he starts a life out in Salt Lake until, mid-construction in his house, he's called to southern Utah. It happened a few times to folks. He would be heavily involved in militia efforts, he would be a, let's say, a large part of the Mountain Meadows Massacre in 1857. So for that, he's arrested in 1874 and then executed by firing squad. And if it sounds like we're skipping over a lot, we are. I promise you, as patriarch of this podcast, I really need like a badge.
Or a patch.
A sash.
A sash.
I need a sash. That on it. Patriarch of the podcast. Promise you, we'll go in lots more detail once we get into Utah, because nothing will keep LHP from Southern Utah polygamy. Nothing.
And don't you worry, we aren't done with Lee or Bathsheba as auxiliary president of this podcast. I can promise you that both show up in an important history later on in Utah. But just remember their foundations for their stories, and we'll come back to them later again. Because when we think about Mormon history, I want you to think not just about the stories we know them, but generational trauma should be introduced into this Mormon narrative, because we see it, in my opinion, after you know the sort of discursive history of Mormonism, it shows up over and over again, and John D. Lee is a perfect example of that. So hopefully you've enjoyed our first installment of Before They Were Famous.
This episode might have been before they were famous, but these books we're going to talk about, they were always famous. There was no before. On Bathsheba, back to our broken record here. Because she's a woman, she's not worthy of her own biography. So we do hear about her in a bunch of different places. So, for example, in the first 50 years of Relief Society, she shows up there. Obviously, she'll show up in biographies of George A. But yeah, she's one of those big gaps in Mormon biography, of which there are lots. She would be very interesting because she is around for so long. I mean, she lives, and we're talking about her Nauvoo, she lives until 1910. She lives into the next century, so she definitely deserves more. John D. Lee, Juanita Brooks' biography of him is both interesting, both for what's in the book, but the book itself is so fascinating. So as kind of an outgrowth of her Mountain Meadows book, she starts getting interested in Lee. She writes the book, but then she starts to hear about rumors that Lee is going to have his blessings restored. And she's like, oh, great. That'd be a perfect thing to throw in the book. Church leaders hear about this are like, don't you dare. You put that in the book, we will rescind this action. And she's like, wait, so if I put this in the book, you're going to punish John D. Lee? How does that make any sense? And
don't give any spoilers for my biography I'm almost done writing.
Okay, shh, don't let Lindsay hear. This is such a cool story. So she publishes the book, and the deal she makes is she's like, okay, fine, I won't put it in the first edition. So she publishes this incredibly small print run, 209 copies of the first edition. That's it. And then immediately she has the publisher start doing the second printing, which is much bigger, in which she puts in the reinstatement of Lee's blessings. And church leaders are like, damn it, we told her not to do that. And so they for a while, are threatening to excommunicate her. And that's where spoilers will stop. But the biography is very interesting. John D. Lee is such a colorful person. And if you would like a fictional take on Mr. John D. Lee, Judith Freeman wrote a novel called Redwater, which is so interesting.
I'm so glad you mentioned it. It's the book that got me started on the podcast here, Polygamy.
I'm trying to remember who told me about the book, but I read it and it was so fun. And then I got to meet her at Sunstone. She, I'm trying to think which of one of her books had just come out. I can't remember, but I got to meet her, and that was fascinating. Such a lovely woman. She was very, very nice.
Yeah, we came to Sunset, and she did her memoir. Blanking on it right now.
Yeah, oh yes, that's right.
It's really great, too. It's not as good as Redwater, in my opinion. Sorry, Judith, but Redwater is my favorite.
Yeah.
Just because her history is so good.
Yeah. Oh, she's a very, very good writer. Yeah. I think she does such a good job of bringing out what it was like to be crazy, violent, zealous.
And I think she talks about John D. Lee was good with his hands.
Yes.
She knew her stuff.
Yes. Tummies. There's some tummies in the book. Yes. Yeah, a very, very good book. So you get a biography and a novel about him. So all very fun and interesting reads.
For my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com. And consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.